Everybody have a handout. Very good. Okay. Let's come together in prayer, and then we'll get started. Let's pray. Father, any creation that we imagine, anything that we create, we only see in light of your Son, our Lord, the firstborn of creation. We give you thanks for giving us eyes to see, minds to think, imaginations to imagine with, and the creativity to engage and solve problems and imagine better things as you would have us to do. Be with us and give us your grace today. Amen. Now, I hope you've come ready to move quickly, not just because of the time that we have, although that is a limit. Obviously, we've only got about an hour, and I like to talk about creativity, so I could go on for a while longer than that. But I've also found that in this particular topic, that to really get us going, I like to keep it stepping. So we're going to be doing kind of alternating back and forth between exercises, and then we'll work on the exercise a little bit, just reflect briefly, and then we'll go back to another exercise, and then we'll talk about that. Then we'll go back again and do another exercise, and then we'll talk about it, and just kind of back and forth, back and forth. We move quickly. It's fairly intensive. I like you to stay engaged, and in fact, I'm going to be asking you to. Especially as we get toward the end, it's going to be ramping up and getting more intense. So I think you'll find the rhythm as we go along. There is reasoning behind it, I promise you. So here's some basics. I just put the question out there right away. What is it that makes some writers more effective than others? What makes some writers more effective than others? Is it just some kind of innate ability? Is it just something that they're born with? Well, okay, that has something to do with it, obviously. But there's another factor that's involved in creativity that I'm convinced and more convinced is just as significant as some kind of innate ability. And I think that other factor is that some writers are more effective than others because they are creative problem solvers. Okay? Some writers are more effective than others because they are creative problem solvers. Did you get that? Okay? I mean that they're effective because they are motivated to present relevant and novel content to a particular audience. That structures the whole talk right there. And this is good news for all of us because creativity, if it's not just an innate skill that some people are born and privileged with, if it's not only that, then it's a skill. And if it's a skill, it's something that can be exercised and learned. That's good news. Now, an exercise. Let me show you this. You're going to need a piece of paper and a pen. There might be room on your handouts, although I'm not certain there is. I'll let you decide. This exercise I'm going to call the Medieval Happy Meal. I haven't gotten my children very many Happy Meals, but when I was younger, we spent some time on the road, and occasionally we'd swing by McDonald's. And for 99 cents at that point, it's gone up some, for 99 cents you could get a little tiny hamburger, a few fries, a little drink, and a little toy. What I want you to imagine, what I want you to work at, what I want you to problem solve, is imagine with me, what would a Happy Meal be like 700 years ago? And your goal is to write down as many toys as you can imagine, which would be ideally situated for children 700 years ago, that they would receive had there been McDonald's. Okay? If there had been a Happy Meal, what or could be in those little boxes as prizes? Don't be afraid to fudge a little bit on the historical details. Give yourself a few privileges like plastic or something like that. Otherwise, what I want you to do is just take 3 minutes and write down as many toys as you can. Keep writing, keep on moving, do not stop, and when we're done, we will discuss the results. Any questions before we go? Do you know what you're doing? Great. The medieval Happy Meal, 3 minutes, go. You're 1 minute in. Don't give yourself the luxury of slacking off. Keep going. That's 2 minutes. 1 minute left. Don't stop. Push through that creative burn. Ten seconds. Keep going. Time. Pens down. Okay. As much as I'd really like to spend time hearing all of your ideas, let's hear some of them. What are your best ideas? The medieval Happy Meal.
Whistle.
A whistle. Helpful. That could be useful. Get lost in the woods, take your Happy Meal whistle with you. Right.
A pretty stone.
Yeah, it's very practical. Good.
A tiny pewter cup.
Great.
A carved cow.
Mm-hmm.
Fabric and a needle.
Excellent. Yes.
A little bow for shooting toothpicks.
Wonderful. Yeah. Put a couple of characters with. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
A ball of string.
Uh-huh.
Clay tablet with letters or pictures in it.
Definitely. Okay.
Cloths with your favorite knight's coat of arms.
Yes. Action heroes, right?
Chess pieces. Okay. One at a time, though, so you'd have to come back.
Give this man a job. Well done. Okay, one more. I'm sorry. A corn husk doll. Excellent. Okay. There's a lot going on here. I wish we could slow down. We need to keep moving. I want to just say, though, what are some things that we could have learned through this? So I'm going to pause here for just a minute and back up a little bit further and ask, what could we learn from an exercise like this? Well, the first thing I think you can learn, this is low-hanging fruit, is that motivation is a great challenge. Okay? The most common excuse we use to justify our inability to generate ideas in greater quantity and quality is most often lack of time. But here, in 3 minutes, you generated how many ideas? 10, 15, maybe even 20 ideas if you're stretching pretty far for this exercise. So clearly, time isn't the only barrier. Sometimes motivation is the barrier. But the second thing, and here we're going to back out just a little bit more further, and I think this is more interesting as well. We can graph the shape of creative ideation. Ideation is just the process of making ideas or of creating them. And we can graph that process wherein Q can stand for both the quality and the quantity of our ideas, quality and quantity, and time. And this is in the process of brainstorming ideas. And it comes out something like this. You might have noticed this. It's fairly consistent that when you start off in a brainstorming process, very quickly you achieve a very high quantity of ideas. As time goes along, what tends to happen is it starts to drop off. And this is where people tend to stop. And that's unfortunate. Because what happens as time progresses, if motivation continues, there's a second spike. And then, as time progresses, ideas and ideation tends to taper off. Okay. Now, I'd love to dive more deeply into that. It's just to say that what happens quickly is the obvious ideas, the low-hanging fruit, the ones that are most instantly accessible to you, are clearly the first ones you get. And there's a fair number of them out there. Those are the relevant ideas, the ones that really stick close to the problem. What happens is those taper off, your brain has to start working harder. It has to start reaching further backwards into memory. It has to project itself further forward into the future situation that you haven't been to, but you can't imagine yourself in, or the one 700 years ago, you're imagining yourself back then at McDonald's. You have to begin probing back into that situation. Your imagination sparks, your memory starts to really be accessed, and that's where you get that second spike. These ideas are the ones that tend to have more novelty to them, that tend to be also relevant, and in the end tend to be more compelling. So what I'm saying is, stay motivated in the process. Because if you just stop here, you've shortchanged the real wealth of ideas that come later in. Okay. So I'll just sum up, and then we'll go into the three components of creativity I talked about. And I'm just going to summarize this first introductory section by saying this. The perspective that creativity is something that's mostly innate, something mostly that we're born with, coupled with years of indirectly and inadvertently training ourselves to solve problems quickly and efficiently, eventually shrinks down that creative center of our minds. Because creativity is not just innate. Have you caught that? It's trainable. It's learnable as a skill. And those writers who excel at creativity do so because they are motivated to meet the problems of their audience with relevant and novel solutions. Okay. This is why I care about creativity. I'm going to identify real quick here the three components of creativity, and that's relevance, novelty, and motivation. And I like to relate them somewhat like this, around a triangle, because they're all present simultaneously in a creative solution. And when you're thinking creatively, relevance, novelty, and motivation are all going to be present in any mingling or any category, any different shape of them. They all have to be there for a solution to really be a creative one. Okay? So let's define them. Relevance is the degree by which a solution actually solves a problem thoroughly. Novelty is the degree of difference or originality that the solution exhibits. And third, motivation is the internal or external forces that drive us to creative solutions. Okay? You get them all down?
That's novelty again.
Great, thank you. Novelty is the difference or the degree of difference or originality that a solution exhibits.
And the relevance?
Relevance is the degree by which a solution actually solves the problem thoroughly. And I'll just say motivation. Motivation is the internal or external forces that drive us to creative solutions. First, let's talk about relevance. Now, as adults, we tend to excel. We do really well with relevance. And again, that's that first blip of brainstorming activity, and that's full of relevant ideas. Relevant ideas tend to solve the problem thoroughly, but they usually lack novelty. Now, chances are the ideas that you view to be the least creative tend to be the ones that are most relevant. And I'm insisting that if you want a solution to be truly creative, it does need to be relevant, not just novel. So don't forget about relevance. We tend to give it kind of low shrift. Don't do that. So our goal is to generate and to identify ideas that maintain relevance. Otherwise, we're not really solving problems. Then we can add novelty. Okay? Novelty is that freshness, that spark. Relevance is what actually solves the problem. You have to be relevant, and then you can add novelty. Otherwise, we're not solving problems. An exercise. Here we go. You'll need a pen and a paper. I think there might be space on your notes. However, I'm not going to reassure you. Make your mind. Imagine this problem with me. You're standing on the doorstep in the rain. It's raining pretty hard, and you have two armfuls of groceries in what's kind of outdated, but two armfuls of groceries in paper bags. The porch is wet. There is no awning. The door is locked. The keys are in your pocket. Your arms are full of groceries. Don't forget that. How do you get into the house? And I need to emphasize that no option is off the table. So long as you can get into the house, problem one, with the groceries in the bags and intact, problem two. Now, what I'd like for you to do is to solve this problem for me using your skills of relevance in any way you see fit. Do you understand the problem? Good. And the exercise is to identify in short sentences, perhaps, as many solutions as you can. Ready? I'll give you 2 minutes. Go. That's 1 minute, one remaining. Ten seconds. Time. Now, let's hear a few. How did you get in the house with the groceries intact?
Back up to the window and cave it in with your backside and knock out the glass with your elbows and step over the sill and duck in.
I said there were no options off the table. Yes. Very good.
Start yelling from a wife.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Start yelling from a wife.
Yes. Please.
Ask your child to take the keys out of your pocket.
Excellent. Yeah. You filled in some details. Another? Ask your child to take the keys out of your pocket.
Run your bags to the car and run into the house and get your bags later.
Very good. Okay.
Put bags in one hand and unlock the door with the other one.
This is possible. A little bit risky, maybe. Yes?
Pinch the one bag between your knees under your skirt.
Awkward, but it's working. Yes.
And set it on your feet.
Yes. Very good. Okay.
It's the house to hold the bag.
Uh-huh. I've done that.
Run around to the back door, which is unlocked.
Yes, very good. One more.
I got one. Go in the garage and go through the connecting door.
There it is. Okay, well done. Excellent. So the question is, how did you do that so quickly? How was your mind operating to do that so quickly? We've identified here, you know, at least 10. There's more ideas floating around. I know that. How to get in. Yeah. And possibly of your own well-being, right? I would suggest this. I'm asking a question a little bit rhetorically. I'd suggest that the first thing you did, and I kind of gave this to you, is to identify the minimum outcome for success. That's a pretty fancy way of saying it. You identified the minimum outcome for success. Or, a little bit more generally, you found the very least that has to be done for you to solve the problem successfully in a relevant way. That's the minimum outcome for success. The second question, asking rhetorically, how relevant were the responses you generated? Well, all of them, probably. Unless you ignored the minimum outcome for success, every solution you generated was a relevant one. Some were just worse than others, right? In this problem, the minimum outcome for success is getting into the house with the groceries before the bags get wet and break and the groceries fall out. Any solution that doesn't feature that outcome, regardless of how novel or sparkly the creation is, or the creativity there is not relevant. It hasn't solved the problem. So in every problem that you encounter, first identify the minimum outcome for success. And you've got a foundation from which you can begin to add other things like novelty. Okay. So I need to get specific to writing here. In writing, relevance is bringing your message to bear to your audience in a way that your audience understands, is attracted to, and can act on. Bringing your message to bear to your audience in a way that they understand, in a way they are attracted to, and a way that they can act on. Said differently, effective writing will be relevant to the needs and situation of the audience. It's going to address the questions that the audience brings to the writer. Questions like, why should I care? What's at stake? What could I win or what could I lose? Why does this matter? And I'm suggesting that if you demonstrate answers to these questions that your audience brings to you, you're offering relevant solutions to them. If you demonstrate relevance, you're making the minimum outcome for success the needs of your audience and not your own needs. Which if you're writing, if you're speaking, sometimes our own needs as writers and speakers can get in the way of what our audience actually needs. So be relevant to your audience, not your own needs. Okay, that's relevance. Second, novelty. So if relevance is what marks audience-directed communication out, novelty is what adds that sparkle of originality that sets a solution apart. And for better or worse, novelty is what's often seen as the mark of creativity because new ideas are noticeable. They stand out. However, I'm going to return to this. I'm arguing that novelty is not the only or even the most important mark of creativity. So, back to the graph. The first bump is what represents the ideas that are the most relevant. These are the ideas that come easily, but the second bump here is the ideas that begin to get more novel. These are the ones that come after you've exhausted the really obvious low-hanging fruit. But they're also, these ideas tend to be less relevant than the ones that come on the first bump. Okay. So how do we learn to generate ideas that are still relevant, but more novel? Like anything that we want to learn, we practice to the extreme. Okay. With novelty especially, the art is letting yourself temporarily let go of relevance and swing to the extreme and then dial back. There's an exercise for this. Let's practice novelty. You'll need paper and a pen.
Are we supposed to do this without relevance or try to keep that in?
I'll give direction there in just a second. We're going to be trying to let go of relevance, and I think the exercise should be constructed that way too. Good question. I'm going to call this exercise, What's Next? What's next? We'll take 3 minutes for it. Imagine that you're taking a walk in town, and I'm going to identify the minimum outcome for success. I'm going to be binding you down to relevance a bit. You're taking a walk in town, and in the grass beside the sidewalk, you see a tape recorder, one of those old Walkmans, about that big. It's got batteries in it, probably. You see it just lying there in the grass beside the sidewalk. You pick it up, look at it. It looks just fine. Then you press the play button, and what happens next? This will be your task. Your task is to complete the story in as many one-sentence ways as possible. I want you to cast to the extreme. You're working for novelty here. Break the laws of physics if you want to. That's fine. I'm going to give you 2 minutes. Ready? Go. That's 1 minute, one remaining. Give yourself the extreme. Anything is possible. Ten seconds. Time. These have to be good. What did you come up with?
Well, it's connected by Wi-Fi to the lawn sprinkler system and it soaks you.
Absolutely. Good.
The music you hear is heavenly, out of this world, and you wake up and find yourself in heaven after a
heart attack. Whoa, okay. Great.
The recorder says, what did you want to have? A choking cloud of poisonous gas pours out of it, causing you to pass out and the rest of the neighborhood to close the windows against the stench.
Okay. That's fairly close to one of the earlier ones, I think.
The approaching owner price thief.
Yes.
It said, put me back where you found me, so I did.
Nothing happens.
Nothing. This is also an option. Okay. So you can ask yourself of that list, which of these ideas are the most novel? You know, which of these are the most outlandish, you could say? Relevance was pretty easy here because anything that met that minimum outcome for success, which was what happens after you push the play button, anything that satisfied that criteria was relevant. And the only thing you had to think about was what happens after you push play. Anything after that was acceptable. And all I'm suggesting here is that sometimes to solve a problem, we need to be able to step back for a few moments and take a fresh approach. To do that, you suspend relevance for just a little while, and then you swing to the extreme. Then you dial back. Okay? Now, what does it mean as a writer to be novel? Obviously, there's some limits to novelty. Let's say we have if you're working on theology anyway, theologians have a term for novel solutions to the difficult questions we have about God and ourselves. It's called heresy, right? That's not what I'm talking about. Being novel, though, might simply mean saying the same thing in a fresh way. It might mean hunting down tired out words and rehabilitate them, or if they're too tired, replace them. It might mean hunting down concepts that have been depleted or narrowed down and enlarge them. I'm thinking of concepts like simplicity, salvation, creativity, that really do have a wealth of meaning. Okay? With time, sometimes they get narrowed. But most often, being novel only means being radical in the truest sense of the word. And by that, I mean doing the hard work of taking solutions that have been divorced from their meaning and taking them back to their original meaning, their original context, and then elaborating that. Novelty, here I'm wrapping up this section, novelty has become the hallmark of creative quality, but relevance remains necessary to qualify that idea as a true solution. Last, motivation. By now, maybe you're lacking it. Stick with me. Motivation is composed of three aspects: purpose, restriction, and action. I'll be spending the last of our time breaking these three out a little bit further. Motivation is composed of three things: purpose, restriction, and action. Purpose equals problem. Purpose equals problem. Without a problem to be solved, you cannot be creative. This is the fundamental difference between creativity and raw artistry. If a painter paints a beautiful painting, she's creating art. But she's not being creative unless she's solving some sort of problem. Okay? An exercise. For this, I want you to use a piece of paper and your pen and not your notes this time, because this piece of paper will be destroyed in the process. Get a piece of paper and your pen. Let's use something other than your notes. Does everybody have paper that they can use? Wonderful. So to reiterate, until there's a problem to solve, the work that's being accomplished is not creative. And I'm going to give you a problem. I'm going to ask you to poke a hole in this other piece of paper that you have and your writing utensil. Once you've done that, I'm going to give you 15 seconds to use the hole as part of the drawing of a face. Okay, paper up, pens up, put a hole in it. Okay, ready? 15 seconds, draw a face. Five, four, three, two, one. Excellent. Okay, now what you just did was absolutely creative because purpose sprang from problem. You had to find a way to use the hole that you put in the paper as part of the drawing of a face. And some might have used that hole as maybe a mouth. Others might have used it as a mole or an ear or a nostril. It's hard to say. But all of it was creative. The common trait is that the common trait to all of these solutions that you gave was the problem. It provided purpose. So if you want to learn from problems, it's this. A well-designed problem can add or subtract purpose, and consequently, the better the problem, the more purpose. The worse and least refined the problem, less purpose. So think of how much harder the exercise would have been if I'd asked you to punch 7 holes in the paper instead of just 1. It would have been more difficult, but I would also argue there would have been more space for creativity to actually happen. Problem equals purpose. Second, restriction. The first requirement of creative training is, again, purpose. However, the purpose becomes useless if there aren't any restrictions to accompany the problem. There must be obstacles to overcome. It's easy to blame restrictions like limited space, limited time, in short, limited resources for our lack of creativity. But the truth is that restrictions are necessary for motivated creative output. As a matter of fact, the more restrictive the environment, the more creative the opportunity. Another exercise. You're going to want your paper and pen, not the face one, not your notes. Get a fresh piece of paper. And what I'm going to do in this one is run you through a set of guided squiggles. Okay? Your task is to turn four random squiggles into other things. And this activity is virtually unrestricted, unless we alter the rules of the game, which of course is what I'm going to do. What I'd like you to do is separate your paper first into four equal quadrants. So one vertical line, one horizontal line, make four quadrants. Okay, very good. And now, using your non-dominant hand, which for me is my left hand, I want you to create four random squiggles, one in each quadrant. Okay, go ahead. You're creating your own problem. It happens to me too. Got them? Four random squiggles, one in each quadrant. Now that you have your squiggles, you're going to turn each one of these into something different. And I'm going to tell you what to draw. Okay? You can turn the paper at any angle you wish if it helps you. Whatever helps you to see the beginning and the end, and whatever helps you to find something that's actually in those squiggles. You're going to have 15 seconds on each one of them. You can use your dominant hand. Yes. Good. Dominant hands. 15 seconds in the first quadrant. What I'd like you to draw is a face. Go ahead. Five, four, three, two, one. Stop. In the second quadrant, I would like to turn your second squiggle into a fish. A fish. Go. Five, four, three, two, one. The third quadrant. Let's start to make this a little bit more restricted. What I'd like for you to do is turn your third squiggle into something that represents the word dizzy. 15 seconds, dizzy, go. Five, four, three, two, one, time. And the last quadrant. Let's crank this up a little bit harder. For your last squiggle, what I'd like you to do is turn it into something that represents the word angry. 15 seconds, angry, go. Five, four, three, two, one. Time. Hold them up. Show them around a little bit. No. Go ahead. Go ahead. Okay, let's rein it in. Lots of creative energy in this room. So in this exercise, the purpose always remained the same. The purpose was always take the squiggle, turn it into something else. However, what changed was the difficulty. What changed was the restriction. And we were pushing in further and further and further and making the environment more and more restricted as we went along. Did you feel that? Right? Along with the increased restrictions, though, is increased opportunity to develop your creative solution. Your first two squiggles may have been more artistic. However, the last two were probably more creative. If your goal is creativity, I'm wrapping this section up. If your goal is creativity, you must have obstacles to overcome. If a writing project isn't restrictive enough, add more obstacles. If you're given more time or resources than what you actually need, reduce them. For example, say you're asked to write an article about anything you like for as long as you like. Consider just making it 500 words on a specific topic. Okay. Last, the last component of motivation is action. And here is where we'll close. If you have purpose, you have a problem to solve. If you have restriction, you have obstacles in your way to overcome. And there's one more thing, and that's action. Habits, action-forming habits, are formed by repetition and creative problem-solving as a learned skill, because that's no different than anything else, okay? I'll say that again. Let's see if I can get my own thoughts out more clearly. Habits are formed by repetition and creative problem-solving as a learned skill is no different. That seems a little clearer. Habits are formed by repetition and creative problem solving as a learned skill is no different. Bad creative habits are formed by apathy, by ignoring healthy processes, and by letting things just happen to us. The bad deadlines, the lack of energy, the short spaces, the low resources, on and on the list goes. Good creative habits are formed, though, through conscious effort. You've got to be deliberate. Therefore, making creativity a habit means actively seeking out and solving problems with relevance, novelty, and motivation. So as you begin to take action, as you begin to take creative action and form the habit, you can remember three things. First, the problems you solve in your writing do not need to be big problems. You don't need to solve big problems. Second, creative training transfers well. Okay? Creative training transfers well. And by that I mean that the problems that you solve don't necessarily have to be in the medium in which you work. Okay? So this is a section about communication. Ideally, when you're developing creativity, you're working within the realm of communication. However, what I'm also saying here is that to learn creativity, you don't only have to stay within that medium of communication. You can solve other kinds of problems. You can be solving problems at home. You can be solving problems at work. You can be solving any variety of problems in the manner I've described, and that transfers pretty readily over into communication. It's not a one-to-one transfer, but it's pretty good. So wherever you're solving problems, you can discipline yourself. You can develop the habit of creativity, and it transfers to other arenas of life where you likewise need creativity. So, second, creativity transfers well. Third, I'd encourage you to solve problems outside of your competency. Solve problems outside of your competency. by competency here, I just mean the arena where you feel really comfortable, okay? Where you've already developed your creativity, where you've already got some mastery. And now I'm saying, if you want to develop as a creative communicator, as a creative person in general, step outside of what's familiar and reach into areas where you don't yet have competency. Because then you're less likely to get hung up on the quality of your execution. And if you're anything like me, as a communicator, I'm somewhat conscientious, right? I like to get things right. I get hung up sometimes on the quality of me, of my execution. So I'm encouraging us, sometimes it's good to step back and step into an area where you do not yet have developed skill. Get outside of your arenas of competency. Choose problems that will pull out the need for novelty, present opportunities to think beyond the low-hanging fruit. And if it's anything our world needs these days, I think it's people with multiple competencies and developed skills of creativity. As you improve, wrapping this all together, as you improve with your creativity, challenge yourself with harder problems. Add more restrictions or look for problems farther outside of your competencies that will require more research and additional learning. And these will instill the habit of creative problem solving in your life. Let's go back to the very beginning to summarize. I asked the question at the very beginning, what is it that makes some writers more effective than others? It's creativity, I've argued. And creativity as a learned skill is something that can be learned through habitual and determined repetition. Okay, that's all I have. Shall I wrap up in prayer? Okay.
What about wrapping up with Q&A?
We can do that as well. I guess we've got, do we go straight till 2:50?
Yeah.
Very good. We have a few minutes then. Let's use that. Any questions?
Would you have resources that you'd recommend for practical training and some of these things further, ideas and coaching?
Yeah. That's a good question. It's been a little while since I pulled this talk together, so I'm a little bit distanced from the resources. Some key words to look for would be, if you want to go into the theory, it's ideation or ideation. That's the science, the applied science or discipline of forming and understanding how ideas come to be, how they're structured, and how people form them. That's kind of the science end of it. There's more practical training. Oh boy, here I'm falling a little bit flat, I'm afraid. It's like I say, it's been a little bit, I've been too engaged otherwise solving problems.
I don't think I'll be bored for a long time just thinking what you have here.
Okay, make it practical. There's training that's available, I know. I'd encourage you to at least, you can get the contours, but to make it applied, that's glorious, right? Other questions, yes? Yeah.
If you come to an obstacle in your writing, and you ask people for their opinion because you need some help. Mm-hmm. How do you know a true critic that wants to help you from someone that criticizes everybody?
Mm-hmm. Can I turn that to the floor for a minute? Do you have any feedback? How do you discern a true critic who may have your best interest in mind?
Yes.
And could offer relevant and helpful feedback, yes, from just a general critic, right?
I tend to go to people who think with the same processes that I do that will understand what I'm looking for,
mm-hmm,
and what, because one person's writing is not going to reach the universe.
Yeah.
We have different personalities, different everything. So I tend to go to somebody who understands my thinking processes for what I'm looking for, what I'm trying to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't feel so critical as somebody who thinks completely different, who might not think they're being critical, but it, mm-hmm, feels that way.
That's helpful. I would add to that maybe that look for people who are doing it well. Okay, the critics that are just critical, they tend to work themselves into corners after a while, and they're not really engaging any longer. They're not solving problems. So look for the people who are actively out there engaged in solving problems. And I think
what about
I'd value
if you're it. Doing something that you don't know anyone that's doing it well.
Oh, wow. If it's truly pioneering and novel.
Yeah.
You need to talk to somebody that has gotten feedback from that person and find mm-hmm. out whether that person is just naturally a critical person that's hard to please.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So broaden it out a little bit, get into their network.
Get feedback on your feedback.
Okay, mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sometimes the worst of critics would have just a tiny grain of something to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
As odd as it might seem.
A good reminder.
So distance yourself from the criticism for a little bit before you decide whether it's good or bad criticism.
Helpful. Good.
I think, too, that there's just about always something you can learn from criticism, even if that person is just always going to be critical. There's something you can learn if you take it with it, mm-hmm. with a grain of salt. I think that's a skill, though, right? To be able to take any kind of criticism, no matter how overboard, and learn something and improve by that, even if it was not balanced.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Are you ready for another question?
Anything more about criticism?
Go ahead. I was thinking if we... depending how we take them, the critics were throwing out the idea of restrictions being
yes.
helpful. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes maybe even if it is just a general critic or a critic that doesn't really know what he's talking about, we can maybe take them as a restriction that say, okay, well, if that were the case, what mm-hmm. could I do?
Mm-hmm. And then you just found an opportunity for more creativity.
Yeah.
Good.
Another problem to solve.
That's right. Another question. Go ahead.
On the ideation curve, how can I know if I'm still in that first bump or if I've pushed through the dip into the second?
How do you know if you're in just this first low-hanging one or whether you've pushed through? I would say that not all problems are equal, okay? So some problems really don't need to be solved because you've already got well-worn pathways and they're just effective. You find the ruts and you stick to them because it saves you a lot of creative energy. And it's a limited resource, okay? So sometimes just to stick with relevant ideas is actually good. You don't always have to push into the second bump. It's a good question because in a lot of ways I think I've kind of intuited this. You do have certain restrictions you have to work with. When the restrictions begin to press in and you realize that you've pretty much scattered all the novel possibilities and you're only left with a couple, it's probably time to move on and start thinking about execution, which would be the next thing on. Experience, I think, is where I've gone there. Any other response, though? I'll throw it to the floor again. How do you know when it's time to start thinking about just completing it, moving to execution?
Is it when you start sweating?
I usually do that early on, though. You may just exhaust the ideas, though, right? It just I can't think of anything else. When you start producing less ideas of less quality, it's probably time to move on. And all you've got is dynamite in the front door, and your groceries are still getting wet, but it's time to just keep going. Other questions? Yes?
Is an author who has written a number of books... and is always known for, okay, that sounds just like that author.
Yeah.
Is that author uncreative?
That's a good question. I would say, like, if that author refuses to move past the arenas where they're really competent and where they're known, eventually they're going to exhaust their creativity. And there are some authors where when you've read their first book, you've read them all, right? You get to the third or the fourth one and you recognize the patterns. Like, I think I know where this is going. You tend to put down the book after a while. That said, there's a lot of different ways to apply one original idea, depending how much fruitfulness there is in it. Okay. So some of the best thinkers out there can consistently hold to one idea, then apply it to multiple arenas. And that's interesting. But that creativity is still at work. It's when it gets stale. And like the Hardy Boys books or something, we just go on and on. It's time to quit. Okay, yes?
I think sometimes the reason you say that sounds just like this person is because we've gotten used to his wealth of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what keeps appearing, so then you better stay there.
And that's not a bad thing, you're right. Saying. Yes.
But I think they should, like, I have someone in my writer's workshop, and she does nonfiction, and she just recently wrote a poem, and the purpose was because she was getting stuck, or I'm getting stuck, then I try an allegory or something I very rarely write, and it helps you get unstuck.
There's a call to stay tuned into your own abilities, and if you're getting stagnant, try something else.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. I heard the bell. You're dismissed. Thanks for joining me.